Senate State Affairs, come to order. It is 9:01 a.m. on the 28th of January, still 2016. We have members present, Senator McGuire, Senator Huggins, Stoltz, Senator Cockill, and Senator Wilikowski. We have a full complement today. We have continuing presentation on Senate Bill 128, and we've already had the administration describe the title and the intent. Today we had the Harvard Fellow previous presentation. Now we have the Attorney General and Commissioner of Revenue. Welcome. I think a lot of questions were held in abeyance, or kind of the can't say or can't say from your, and I think he was deferring to you. So I think you probably remember a lot of those. You made those questions, probably for efficiency, if you cover some of them in your presentation. So with that, we'll proceed. Welcome, Commissioner.
Chairman Stoltz, members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. I'm here with Attorney General Craig Richards, and Bill Melks with the Department of Law is here as well if there's questions on the specific sections of the section.
And make sure you're closer to the microphone, sir.
Thank you. One of the things I'd like to do before turning it over to the Attorney General is to kind of put into context this particular piece of the governor's plan, because I think some of the confusion that resides surrounds just what is part of which bill, or how does it all fit together. So the Permanent Fund Protection Act is the component of the bill that allows us to maximize the efficiency of our existing wealth in helping to fund government going forward. Just to kind of put it into how we got to this point in time, you'll recall that starting in June, we started a series of meetings statewide talking to Alaskans about the fiscal situation that we had, both to inform them of the severity of it, but also to hear what they had to say. Director Pitney and myself did over 50 meetings statewide over the summer and in early fall, just to get feedback and to understand. But we were talking primarily about standard type government solutions to this problem. We were talking about, you know, new taxes. We were talking about cutting expenditures. We were talking about using the earnings, our wealth, in standard fashions that have been talked about before, endowment type models, POMB, those kind of things. And so that was the bulk of the discussion as we were going around. But there was also, you saw in the news several times, it kind of popped up this idea of how we were going to use our wealth. So we heard, you know, comments about leveraging within the permanent fund and various other things like that. And those were all discussions that's kind of surrounded around a second model for how we could potentially resolve our fiscal issue, which was using our wealth as the primary source. As those started to kind of come to some conclusions, we recognized that using standard processes, if we made draconian enough decisions, we could reach fiscal stability. But what we couldn't do is take the volatility out of the budgeting process, that we would still be chasing oil prices up and down and investment returns up and down, and we wouldn't really have steady state kind of funding source for government. On the other side of the equation, that looked at the wealth, we found that we could take the volatility out of the system, but quite frankly, we didn't have enough wealth to do it all by itself, and that our savings were not sufficient to be able to totally fund government services just from our wealth. And so the two plans kind of coalesced into what you see now in front of you, where that wealth model is used to kind of as a way to maximize our earnings in funding government. But then attached to it is also some very standard approaches to funding government, which is taxes and expenditure reductions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Just on the issue of expenditure reductions, the governor proposes a fairly modest expenditure, might even just be a net wash. Just as we continue, commence on this discussion of the governor's plan, it appears to reside mostly on new revenues, whether it's taxes or the fund. Just maybe your clarification of the as the revenue commissioner, and I guess the governor has stated it. sometimes more clearly, but is this the governor, does the governor believe the current budget he's proposing is the right size and sustainable budget, and any other cuts of any significance would be deleterious and not supported? Is that, I just want to make sure that's the information we've heard in bits and pieces. Is the level of budget that the governor proposes the right sized budget for a sustainable budget? And do we express adamance that's the level that the governor believes is necessary for Alaska? If I've been unclear, ask me to clarify.
All right. I understand the question, Chairman Schultz, and I want to get too far down this path because
that is the center of our path is what.
Right, but I'll answer your question, but I just want to make sure that we stay focused ultimately on
this. This is the focus. We can't talk about taxes and revenues without talking about the budget.
Okay.
So it's
I'll answer your question first, and then I'll move on. The governor has made it clear that this plan works. It does get us to a sustainable budget, but what he has said is it's written in pencil, and that he is willing to talk about the balance between spending cuts and new revenues as a discussion with the legislature to reach a place where everybody is comfortable with it. So he's made it very clear it's written in pencil, and he's willing to engage in discussion. The slide that's up right now, I just want to point kind of the significance of the component. The Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act, which is our focus of this particular bill, was able to generate about $3.3 billion in resolving the state's fiscal situation. When we add to that earnings from existing taxes and savings, we can get up to about 4.2 to 4.3. Our last year's kind of starting budget, if you take out one-time savings, was 5.2. So we've got about $1 billion that we still have to make up. Even with this plan, we still have to close that $1 billion gap, and that's where that balance between the spending reductions and the new revenues comes into play. So the focus today is just on that very top line, that $3.3 billion, the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act.
So, Commissioner, none of us are on finance, but we're on subcommittees. So the governor, the position we're gonna have. The governor's commissioners and OMB working for reductions. That's we're going to have the pencil sharpened and the erasers going. I mean, are we going to see that commitment in the budget process? Finding that other billion that you've acknowledged,
Chairman Schultz, we will be actively engaged with leadership in both the House and in the Senate on working to some kind of compromise that works for everybody.
Senator McGuire. Through the chair, Commissioner, I think that the chair's questions are relevant and important because as we look at this approach or 114 or Representative Hawker's approach, the first question that people in the public have is, are you proposing a plan that purports to equal the current cost and size of government? And what I always say with mine is no. It's meant to be a glide path for us to stabilize the government so that the private sector receives the right signals and so that we can stabilize the economy. But it's also meant to leave enough room for the House and the Senate and the public to have an earnest dialogue about the size and cost of government and what we can really afford. And other states like Wyoming that are almost exclusively hydrocarbon dependent have gone through this thing recently, and with the population they have of just a little over 650,000 inhabitants, their budget is half ours. And so I think what the chairman is trying to get at is that before you're going to walk through the minutiae of it, and that's important and we all will listen to that, but it's a fair question because for any of these endowment approaches, people want to know if they're going to give up a part of what they would conceived to be the protection or the size of their permanent fund dividend that they've been receiving. They want to know that those cuts are being made and that there's a full broad look at what we're doing into the future. So,
through the chair, Senator McGuire, we agree with you wholeheartedly on that. And one of the messages that was very clear in traveling around the state this year was that the price of admission to talking about any of these others is additional cuts. that people are not convinced that government is delivering services as efficiently as it can. But there was a counterbalance to that. People also said they really liked the services that government was delivering. And so so there's kind of that balance point that we're going to have to find within this discussion of, you know, what is it that people want and how willing are they to pay for it. So.
And I just add, the last meeting I just at the end, I asked how many people are in the room that weren't being paid to be here, and only two, and one of them was Jack Ferguson, said he wasn't being paid, and folks can read the newspaper and determine what the case is with that, but one person in this room, as you're having the dialogue, I want to get the answers, I want to talk to myself and my friends. I just put that cautionary out there. I was just at one of the greatest town halls you can go to, and that's a gun show, and people, I didn't have to ask questions. People from all walks of life, I didn't have to ask questions. They were gratuitously and very forcefully offering their opinions, and it wasn't the same as focus groups or conclaves of Alaskans that were assembled at the University of Alaska that were handpicked. So I just, the audience is kind of important. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I second what Senator McGuire said as far as, you know, how the chairman has put forth his question. But there's another component. And one of the steps that we're facing now, it's actually yesterday, about a month ago, is we see the projections that the different revenue enhancement measures would make, what pot of money based on a percentage would be generated, which now we're at the point of, okay, what is the target cut going to be? And so I'll speak for the Senate, now I need to sit down with administration, i.e. the governor included, and figure out what number we're going to rally around, so we can figure out then where we're going to amortize it across the budget. That's usually important. The other one, I've read articles that this poll is not credible, or this one is the perfect one, whatever the case may be. The poll that I'm most confident in is the people that some of them I don't even know, but they are my constituents. And they lead with, you know, there may be some other things that have to be done, but Charlie Huggins, you cut that budget before you talk to me about wanting to take some money out of my pocket. And I think the average Alaskan really believes that, particularly those who are paying attention. And I believe what they're saying, and it's my natural inclination to do that anyway, and I'm just it's good to hear it reinforced. Now, on the other hand, there are a few that I hear from that have their golden watch and do whatever you want to, just don't touch this thing. But by and large, Alaskans are looking for us, but for us, we're down here for 90 days, and we're burning through the second week, and to figure out what that round number is. So what I'm saying today on behalf of the Senate is we need to sit down with the administration and agree upon what that round number is, or odd number it might be. Thank you.
Yeah, I think Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. I would certainly agree it's important that we figure out what the appropriate size of the budget is. But one of the things that I'm hearing from my constituents is, where's the oil production we were promised roughly 3 years ago if we passed Senate Bill 21? This was a slide that you presented just last week in the finance committees. We were told the drop in oil production was stopped. We were told that we were going to get more oil production, and instead what we're seeing is a decline going down below 300,000 barrels in the next 10 years, which has a dramatic impact on our revenue. So I would like to hear I would like to see the administration focus more effort on figuring out where's the oil production that we were promised. And my constituents would like to hear that as well. Thank you.
Anyway, I think we've all staked out our rhetorical ground and what our constituents are concerned about. But I'll let you proceed with your hearing now. I think you have heard some of the points that are important, and I think establishing what our goal is of sustainable government has to be more clearly defined. So, well, onward.
Chairman Stoltz, we've heard that all over the state, so nothing that you said is inconsistent with what we've heard. Just to kind of put it in context before I turn it over to the Attorney General to kind of walk through the plan, one of the things that we have to put in perspective what this really means when this plan is all done. And the governor brought it up in his State of the State speech. But even when we're all done, we will still have some, if not the lowest, individual tax burdens in the country. Even if all of the levers are pulled within this plan, there'll still be a dividend. It'll be different, but there'll still be a dividend. We'll still be able to grow our savings at the rate of inflation or more. We'll be able to provide the bulk of the essential services that people have come to enjoy, and we'll still have money that we can invest in resource development and other things, not again at the same level that we've done in the past, but we will still have that tool in our toolbox as well. So the sky isn't falling, but it will be different than what we're used to, and I think that's kind of the message, that it won't be bad, but it will be different. And finally, just to put the what we're actually focusing on today, which is the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act, and it really does three things. It creates a sustainable draw from the earnings reserve, and the kind of our mandate was to see kind of maximize that draw. What's the maximum that we could take out on an annual basis? It takes the volatility, oil price volatility, out of the budgeting process by putting it into the permanent fund, giving us a steady state revenue stream for funding government services, and it adjusts the dividend. Those are really the three components that this particular piece of the plan does. And with that, I'll turn it over to the Attorney General.
Just on the question of volatility, Commissioner, mm-hmm. So just as it's been brought up by members of both parties, the goal appears to be, just to paraphrase, we want to create less volatility for the government funding mechanism, but put the dividend in the more volatile of resource, and that's protection.
Yeah. And Chairman Schultz, we will have a discussion on that towards the end of the slide pack when we talk about the dividend.
Mr. Chairman and other members of the committee, Attorney General Craig Richards, thank you for the opportunity to present today. The three sections of the presentation that I'm giving, the first short part is just defining the problem and how over the last 6 months as the administration looked at ways we might tap our financial assets, how we looked at the problem. Then I'll discuss sort of the impacts that oil volatility and cyclicality in our economy have on the Alaska economy a little bit. John Kosky will give a larger presentation on this to Senate and House Finance, but unfortunately we didn't have time for him to give it today, so I'll be presenting just a couple of his slides. And the third piece that I'll be talking about is really the options that we examined in developing the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act, including different ways that you might tap your sovereign wealth resources and different rule-based formulas and different policy options, including how you might develop a dividend that is different than the status quo dividend, which Mr. Hoffbeck will talk about. And then finally, if there's time, Bill Milks from the Department of Law is here, and he'll be available to give a very brief sectional of the bill and answer any questions you might have on the legal piece of the bill itself.
And Mr. Attorney General, there's been discussion, it's already been covered by the media, about the conflicting legal opinions. I think we'd be well served to have a discussion about that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might defer that to the end, I'll make sure to leave enough time.
Absolutely.
Because Mr. Milks
we'll
is the one.
We'll just take our ground on that one, because that's of interest to the public. And
great. Wonderful. So Mr. Milks will address that at the end then. So defining the problem. I really think about the problem that we're trying to solve by potentially utilizing our permanent fund assets and our financial wealth in terms of the short-term problem, the medium-term problem, and then the long-term problem. The short-term problem, a fairly obvious one, is that a drop in oil prices has resulted in very large budget gaps. That's the immediate problem before us and has been now for a couple years and has continued to be a problem at current oil price projections and production for a while. The medium-term problem is that the state savings will be spent in about 4 years, and by state savings I mean in particular the Constitutional Budget Reserve and the earnings reserve account as sort of the stabilization accounts that the state has to go to try to ride out a low oil price environment. And of course, the consequence of that is as we approach that four-year cliff, it will drive down consumer and investor confidence in the state economy as the uncertainty associated with large unfunded budgets begins to roll through economic confidence in our state. And then, of course, the next medium-term problem is that ultimately if we do get to a situation where we've run down the CBR and the earnings reserve, it becomes very difficult to rationalize how we could afford to continue to pay permanent fund dividends unless, again, there is a major change to the status quo in the way government is funded. That was where we basically started this exercise, and I would say June and July and August. But as we got into it more and more, and by we, I mean the Department of Revenue, the Department of Law, the Governor's Office, the people that all worked on this collective problem, including Mr. Hoffbeck, we began to not just think in terms of this as a budgeting issue or even a short-term economy issue for the state. We began to ask the question of what is causing the problem? What is driving this reoccurring event in our history where we continue to have these boom and bust cycles? And of course, the answer is that we have a fairly undiversified source of government funding, and we're highly dependent on one resource revenue, which is petroleum revenue from petroleum production, and particularly petroleum production on the Alaska North Slope. And unfortunately for us, it just so happens that that is also a very volatile commodity in terms of how it is priced globally. So the long-term problem we recognized, and this comes out of a lot of the literature that Mr. Reitveld addressed in terms of sovereign wealth funds, the long-term problem is that a highly dependent oil-based government, dependent on oil revenues, just runs the boom and bust cycle of oil prices unless you have either a diversified tax base or you have a lot of sovereign assets that can be used under a fiscal structure to smooth out the boom and bust volatility cycle. And then the last issue that is a long-term trend problem, which is a little different than where we were in, for instance, the mid-1980s or the late 1990s when we last sort of were in this very low-price environment. What is different now is that the North Slope production trends are much lower. We're producing 500,000 barrels a day versus 1986 when we were trending up to 2.1 million barrels a day, in the late 1990s where we were still over 1 million barrels a day. And barring change, we all hope there will be change, of course, as Senator Wilikowski has aptly pointed out, the production decline trend is going down, which means, of course, that even spikes in oil prices on a long-term trend won't completely solve the budget hole when production levels get low enough, if they continue the same downward trend. So I've got just three quick graphics that demonstrate the problem. This is petroleum and non-petroleum revenues collected by the state of Alaska over roughly the last 10 years. As you can see, and certainly everyone in this committee is aware of, it's incredibly volatile. We had as little as this last year under $2 billion in revenues coming into the state. We had a high in 2008 of over $10 billion. And as recently as 2013, we had over $6 billion just in petroleum revenues coming into state coffers. Now, as you can imagine, it becomes very difficult without substantial savings and without a lot of discipline to manage this kind of volatility in a year-to-year budget economy, year-to-year state budget, or national budget for that matter. So that's one of the things we're going to be talking about, is maybe there's potentially some improvements we can make in our fiscal system to try to manage these up and down cycles driven by oil prices in our economy. Here's the medium-term problem that I spoke about, and this graphic is one that demonstrates, you know, at the bottom, the existing revenue, again showing that it's come down pretty dramatically in the last 5 years. And the black and the gray is the short-term savings that has spent down. We started with the statutory budget reserve. That got spent to, I think, what is pretty close to zero at this point. We're now on track to, in the next roughly 2 years, to spend down the constitutional budget reserve down to zero. And again, this is status quo, assuming no change. And then ultimately, we're in a position where in maybe 2 years after that, barring change, the likely outcome will be that we spend down the permanent funds earnings reserve down to zero as well. And that leaves the white budget hole. Now, you'll notice that the earnings reserve never really goes to zero, because it does produce statutory net income out of the corpus every year. So there will be, you know, a slice of money available from the earnings reserve every year, but it is unlikely, barring change, that the amount it produces can be anything like what will be necessary to plug the budget hole on a go-forward basis by itself. And this next slide evidences the long-term problem. And I think this slide is interesting. And it's interesting because what we've done is we've overlaid the unrestricted petroleum revenues, which is the solid line, with the state unrestricted budget. And what we see, and I don't think it's a surprise to anyone here, is that the state budget is highly correlated to the amount of petroleum revenues that we receive. And in fact, it's not just highly correlated. The Economics Research Group ran, you know, a standard regression, and the R-squared correlation is 0.83 on the state budget compared to last year's petroleum revenues, which just from a statistical perspective means that there is indeed a very high level of correlation between what we spend and how much money we brought in the prior year. So what is the consequence of that? Well, the consequence is, I'll talk about a little bit, pro-cyclical spending. It means when times are good, we spend more money. In particular, we tend to have very large capital budgets. And this is when our economy is doing well, mind you. So our economy is doing good because oil prices are high and North Slope activity is doing well. So we spend a lot of money in capital budgets, and our operating budgets tend to go. Then when our economy starts doing bad in the private sector because oil prices come down, we react in sort of the opposite of basic Keynesian economics. We slash our capital budgets, and we try to claw back our operating budget, which makes the impact on the economy more dramatic, and it makes the downturn potentially stronger. And obviously, probably the biggest example of this was the 1980s when, you know, the government's requirement to slash spending so rapidly and dramatically, it's almost like the way Hoover cut spending in the Great Depression. You know, it just results in, you know, a real economic shock. So that's obviously something we're trying to avoid. But more long-term, what the plan is trying to do is it's trying to get off this high correlation between government spending and commodity prices and get us off this boom and bust roller coaster of government spending and instead put us on something that looks more like stable governmental spending, at least for part of our budget, to remove the volatility.
And Mr. Attorney General, I just, if I'm trying to figure something out, I wonder if other people are too, and maybe they're smarter than me, but I'm trying. One of the concerns you and the Walker administration expressed is you're concerned about the eradication of the constitutional budget reserve within a very short period. Your solution is to take the constitutionally protected budget reserve that was approved in 1990 and put it in statutory funds, which then require a 21 vote, 11 vote margin. It doesn't even seem like if there's an Allodia problem, we're not even using a selective herbicide, or you're going to kill the whole pond and put it in there. I'm trying to understand the dynamics it's in danger, so we're going to kill it and put it somewhere else that's not protected. I'm still trying to grasp that as you're going through this, and that's I won't even get into how you're going to get the 3/4 votes Steve Miller sang a song like Abracadabra, I think, and it's going to take something like that to get 3/4 votes on that. We couldn't get them to sustain the budget last year. Two questions. I'm trying to understand the mechanics of, if you're worried about the CBR being gone, your solution is to remove the constitutionally protected and put it in some statutory accounts. I know what the history on statutory accounts has been. It's gone real fast, whether Sheffield created them or Cooper. This is just a lay. I'm trying to understand this. I'm having a hard time grasping it. It just seems counterintuitive, and I'm sure there's some magic there that I don't understand, and I'll let you, the magicians, explain it.
First of all, I think we need to recognize the enemy of fiscal stability is no plan. Right. I mean, that really is it's not the plan itself. I mean, there's multiple ways to get to the solution, but the enemy is no plan at all.
Or can the enemy be a bad plan, too?
A bad plan is better than no plan.
Okay. Thank you, Sam.
Because at least you
make you a colonel. He knows a little about strategy.
because then at least you have a measure against your success. And when you have no plan, you have no measure against your success. Our plan up to this point in time is we save 25% of our wealth by putting our royalties into the permanent fund. That's been successful. We've grown a fund to $50 billion. We've taken any excess earnings in any given year, put it into savings, into the CBR for basically taking care of these volatile time periods. And then we just chased oil price up and down. That's the plan that we've been working on. So the mindset here is we need to take the volatility out of the entire system. And so the issue with the CBR is not that the concern about us spending it in one place or another, but spending it without a plan on how it's going to be spent and how it's going to be best used to sustain our capabilities going forward. It's not an apples to apples comparison about spending it versus putting it into the earnings reserve, because putting it into the earnings reserve actually does take volatility out of the system, because although the CBR was intended to protect and create some kind of buffers against spending money, it's largely been destabilizing in the budgetary process versus stabilizing, in that in order to get that three-quarter vote, sometimes compromises are having to be made that just probably wouldn't have been made otherwise. And so we see that we have more stability in that cash flow if that money is not subjected to the three-quarter vote. And that's the logic behind it.
Are there any other parts of the Constitution relating to spending the permanent fund that are going to be problematic you guys might need to look at as well? You identified one that's problematic for the administration. That's the voter-approved CBR, which started out as a spending limit and morphed into the CBR fund.
Right.
Voters approved it pretty overwhelmingly.
Yeah, I would defer.
Is that the only constitutional problem you guys have? I mean, the only problem with our existing constitution that we want to try to sidestep?
Chairman Stoltz, I don't think we're trying to sidestep the constitution at all. It's going to be a vote of the legislature, just as it's laid out statutory and constitutionally. It's going to be a decision that's made whether that's more appropriate place for that money to reside or not. We're not trying to circumvent any constitutional provisions, but we are trying to stabilize cash flow.
Proceed. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't know if Senator Wilikowski is going to get into a discussion of this, but I'll just open the door to it briefly, just because I want to hear on the record. I think it's an interesting philosophical discussion about whether or not it's appropriate to take the constitutionally protected CBR and move it into a statutory place. I think it's a very interesting question. I think the chairman makes good points for why you shouldn't. I think you make some good points for why you should. But there's a legal opinion that I know Senator Wilikowski received and others have been in conversations about it, and I wanted to know if you're aware of the debate or the conversation about whether or not your plan might have some challenges with respect to the other monies that are put into the ERA, that there seems to be concrete legal opinion that says that if it's the earnings reserve account, that it's not the general fund, and that is not sweepable, and there we go. But that your plan is unique in that it's attempting to pull other funds into the ERA and to sort of, in a way, perhaps you could say, sidestep the general fund terminology. And there's a question about whether or not that's appropriate or whether or not the Supreme Court might come back and narrow their opinion in Hickel. And I just wanted to hear on the record what you thought about that. Should this Senate, should this House move into adoption of that part, that tenet of your plan, I'd like to know whether you've thought about that risk and how you would intend to approach it. And maybe it's for the Attorney General.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, I'll talk about the impact it would have on the plan, and the Attorney General can talk about whether that's a real concern or not that we need to deal with. But ultimately, the plan works whether the money resides in the earnings reserve or the CBR, as long as the investment process is similar in both places. The issue is, though, that when it's in the CBR, we have a little bit less certainty on the annual draw because it's subject to the three-quarter vote. So it's not a fatal flaw if the money gets swept back into the CBR. It just leaves us in that annual three-quarter vote in order to pull that money out.
And I'll just clarify, the only thing I've staked a position on today is on the sustainable budget level. I'm trying to not to make a final evaluative judgment on this, but I'm trying to ask questions to help us understand the mechanics. It has a little bit of Rube Goldbergism in it. We're talking about altering, whether it's through the statutory vote, the three quarters that the governor is going to be able to finesse. I want us to be able to stand and understand. I want the public to understand that it's just because a lot of this has been on bromides. Well, let's do something, have a plan, not every plan is necessarily, don't always confuse motion with progress.
Chairman Stoltz, again, with back to Senator McGuire's comment, would you prefer to deal with that issue now, or we do have it kind of teed up at the end of the presentation to talk about that?
Oh, I'd be happy to wait.
Okay.
Me too.
Okay.
No problem.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, but Mr. Milks will address that, and I think, as Mr. Hoffbeck indicated, that law thinks that the CBR sweep isn't necessary, but even if it is, it's not fatal to the plan.
Okay.
So my last point on this slide would be really defining the long-term problem that the administration is trying to address, which is really to try to take this high correlation between state spending and the last year's petroleum revenues, was that I might suggest that that correlation becomes less and less feasible over time for us. And it becomes less feasible for two reasons. One is because with smaller and declining oil production, you have less volatility to capture in the up years. The second reason is, as I believe Dr. Tohosky will testify, and he knows the reasons why, it's at least his opinion that we're actually going into a more volatile world for oil prices than we currently are. This next slide addresses a study that was done by the International Monetary Fund in October, and there was actually an earlier paper, I believe in the spring, maybe April, where they looked at, they did a study on commodity-based economies. And of course, one of the repeated themes that I think that we should all realize is that Alaska and its budget challenges right now is not alone. We're not unique. We're in a different budget challenge than most of the lower 48 states, because most of the lower 48 states aren't petroleum or other resource dependent for their state budget. But on a global basis, there are many national governments and there are many provincial governments that, like us, do have this high level of dependence on one economy. And right now, it's not only oil prices that are low relative to a 10 or 15 year trend, there are a lot of mineral prices that are low as well. So there's a lot of different economies going through this. So this issue is sort of a hot-button topic in a lot of, you know, international finance circles, and as Milan talked about, even in the sovereign wealth community. So this particular study, which I thought was useful, looked at 85 economies over the last three decades. And what it found was exactly what we've experienced in the state of Alaska, which is that government spending in commodity-based economies tends to move up and down with commodity revenues. And as I said, this is referred to as pro-cyclical spending. When your economy is doing well, you spend more. When your economy is doing bad, when normally you would want to use government funding to maybe bottom out the trough a little bit, we nonetheless tend to spend less. So rather than counter-cyclical government spending, which is maybe a little bit better governmental policy, at least in terms of your economy, we tend to have very strong and high correlations to pro-cyclical spending. And what the study found, and I encourage everyone to read it, it's an interesting paper, is that those commodity-based economies, they were able to use fiscal policy to smooth out the volatility of commodity prices, experience something like an average of 0.3% increase in GDP growth year to year. Now that may not seem like a big number, 0.3% GDP growth, but compounded over a generation, it's a huge number. It's the difference between having maybe a mediocre economy and a good economy. So this idea at least suggests if we can smooth out this volatility and get off the boom and bust curve in state spending and ultimately in our economy, that we can probably not just have a easier to go budget, we can actually grow our real economy over time. Now this slide presents some information that Mr. Reitveld already presented, so I'm trying to keep it very short. And this shows the break-even oil price is estimated in some of the studies for the different oil regimes. And as Mr. Reitveld said, Alaska at a $109 break-even price, I think it might be a little higher this year actually, is somewhere in the range of Saudi Arabia, Russia. We're not quite as bad as Nigeria, but we're certainly not in that group of oil economies that have break-even oil prices in the $50 and $40 and $60 range. That's really a lot more sustainable for their budget economies on a year-to-year cash flow basis. And I just want to reiterate what Mr. Reitveld said, because I think if there's anything that I took away from his presentation the first time I saw it, it was this idea that well-managed petroleum economies have done one of two things. By and large, I'm sure there's exceptions, but by and large, they have either enacted broad-based tax measures that makes the amount of petroleum revenue to the total budget small enough that the volatility doesn't kill them, or, in the alternative, they have attempted to use their sovereign wealth assets to smooth the volatility. And, you know, the earlier examples of they have broad-based taxation in lieu of a high dependency on oil on a year-to-year budget, you know, that's Canada, that's Australia, that's Norway. What these things all have in common, these countries, is that they all had well-developed first-world economies before their petroleum wealth came into line, before the petroleum wealth came online. Alaska, in that sense, is much more like a Middle Eastern or African country, in the sense that we probably don't have the economic base to sustain the kind of revenues that we get now and we've become used to the last couple of decades off oil. So in some ways, when you think about this trying to smooth, maybe a different model to look to might be countries more like Abu Dhabi and Kuwait, and as was recommended for Saudi Arabia, but they haven't adopted, is instead of trying to use broad-based taxation to smooth the volatility and get you off the boom-bust cycles, use your sovereign wealth assets in a manageable way.
Normally, I wouldn't ask the Attorney General a revenue question, but you've been placed right in the middle of this discussion. But just to help us out on where the administration is heading, are you looking at, how are you looking at oil prices? Short-term blip, and we'll return to normalcy or whatever that's defined as? Are you looking at a permanent readjustment in our economy or long-term, which is almost as good as permanent? How are you approaching the volatility? And that will help us try to figure out this. What's the philosophy? I'm sure you've chatted about what your expectations are, and that will help us and the public understand where you're coming from better.
So, Mr. Chairman, the way I think about oil prices is I think that I don't know. And I don't mean that as a smart aleck answer. I mean it as that's literally how I think about it. And one of the great slides I've seen that the Department of Revenue puts out is the annual oil price forecast that they, and I think it might even contain some other projections, do. And essentially, it's kind of whatever point in time you are, the forecast is just sort of a straight line going across. So even though oil prices are, you know, highly volatile and move around a lot, you know, we tend to just have real tendency bias to think recently that the current oil price is something like the future oil price is going to look at. But the way I think about it is over a long enough time horizon, at least if history repeats itself, we're going to hit the whole spectrum of oil prices. So you might be able to estimate with some amount of reason what oil prices might be in a year or two, but no one can estimate what oil prices are going to be in 10 years. All we know is that there's a large distribution, and it's likely that they will reach across all aspects of that distribution. So Mr. Hoffbeck might have a different view.
No, my view is very similar. I think if you look at the revenue's official position, we see volatility increasing within oil prices. Because of the, in the past, most of the oil development was on these long lead, big field development type projects where, you know, once the investment was made, the oil continued to flow regardless. Now we see with the shale oil where you have relatively low expenditures to bring on product fairly quickly at a price point in the $60, $70, $80 price point that seems to be putting some kind of a cap on kind of the ceiling of where we think it's going to go, but can easily flood the market and depress the price over and over again. So we're looking at $50 to $70 long-term real price on oil with a lot of volatility.
Longer term, Mr. Commissioner? Or?
We're looking, you know, that's in that 3 to 10 year.
Which is a lifetime in our political system.
Right. Senator Wilkowski and then McGuire.
All of your projections are predicated on the idea that oil production will continue to decline. Even when oil prices were in over $100 a barrel just last year, 2 years ago, oil production was projected to continue to plummet. Are you asking the industry where the new production is? We were promised a lot of new production. I heard probably $30 million worth of TV radio ads saying if we pass oil tax reform, we're going to get all kinds of new production. And I'm seeing declining production going out for the next 10 years. I saw that when oil was $100 a barrel 2 years ago. Where's the new production?
Through the chair.
Because that makes a huge difference. If you double the production like we were promised, we bring in billions of dollars of new revenue. I'm not seeing anything contemplated about new production.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. Our forecasts are based on the meetings with industry and what their forecasted investment is and fields that they feel that they can bring online. And so our forecast is consistent with what we are being told by industry when we meet with them. I can't answer the broader political question of what happened to the oil that may or may not have been promised. But those numbers are directly related to what industry is telling is a reasonable expectation for investment and production.
And Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, if I might, the Department of Revenue's forecasts are fairly conservative in that they take a status quo world, they add a little activity to it, and they project that out. What they don't project is substantial new events. So they don't incorporate into their projections the discovery of a large new field. They don't incorporate into their or the development of an existing known large field. They don't put into their forecast any oil associated with the opening of ANWR or barrel oil equivalent energy that might come out of a gas line or something off of, you know, offshore. So the status quo in Alaska right now, barring change like shale or heavy oil or something coming out of Kuparuk or Milne Point, is a declining oil base. So unless something new happens, we're on a declining trend curve. That said, I think that some DNR folks and others are optimistic that there is some to good probability that we will have some new things happening.
Let me put some through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, just to kind of perspective on what it really would take, though, to get there. Even at $55 to $60 oil, we would need 1.6 million barrels a day to balance the budget. We're at 500,000 right now, so we're at about a third of that. You know, we've heard some industry folks talking about a discovery in the Colville Delta that's kind of between the size of Alpine and Kuparuk. That's in the 100,000 to 200,000 barrel a day range. We would need five of those in order to get to a balanced budget. That is not anywhere on the horizon. And so production just simply isn't going to save us.
Senator Higgins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't want to get into the debate of how you develop plans, but we talked earlier about good plan, bad plan. I think the trait of a reasonable plan is clearly when you have unknowns, you do bands of assumptions, right? So, I mean, I would ask us to do that, right? The other one, because we have an administration that has subject matter experts on pipelines, gas pipelines, and they spent 30 or 40 years developing that. Someplace there has to be overlaid on the plan. Pipeline yes, pipeline no. Price is X, transportation costs Y, on construction costs X, and so that we kind of see what it looks like. And you know, we don't have the luxury of only sitting here and talking about what we're going to do with the permanent fund. We have a whole buffet. Mm-hmm. Of things that we're being asked to do, and we have to look at how to synchronize that. But the task of the proposer, the administration, is to synchronize that so that we don't have to agree with the synchronization. We can compare whatever our synchronization of those are in the overlays. It's kind of like maps. I spent a little time in the military. You have a map, then you put overlay one, overlay two, and you look at all. And after a little while, you get confused, and you have to change the colors and what have you. But you have to make an assumption on what the scenarios are. That's number one. I just ask us to think about that, but we have to do it. And if you don't do it, we have to do it, and our assumptions may be different than yours, but we need to compare our assumptions, number one. You know, Mr. Chairman, the bid's making promises. I don't know about promises. Promises, the eye of the beholder. The one that the effect on the Alaskans that I've hung my head on is a promise you can keep your your insurance policy, you can keep your doctor, all those kind of things. There are lots of what we think were promises. Was that a promise? I don't know. It was. I listened to the president say, "Where you can, Charlie Huggins," and I'm not so. But he, I didn't know. So I haven't heard the term promise, but maybe it was expectation.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, we have run analysis looking at the impacts of not only the returns we would get on a gas line investment, but also the costs associated and where that fits into the totality of our ability to fund the gas line. So those analyses have been run. At some point, I think we could share them with you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm just asking. At some point in time, we're there now, right? Uh-huh. I mean, we're sitting there looking down the task at hand that we're going to try to grapple with. So, at some point in time is now. It's actually yesterday. Anyway.
Senator McGuire. I think Senator Huggins is right, and no reason that you would necessarily know that. This is, it's a new administration. This is your first big complex matter that you're putting before the legislature, but there's a timing to things that you just sort of figure out, and you can feel when the members just are ready to completely drill down on it, and that's the time you just take advantage mm-hmm. of it and completely immerse them, because you can sort of see here, all of us had other interests maybe 2 years ago we thought we might accomplish in 2016, and they're just gone. I mean, they're not even off the shelf now. So this is what people are focusing on. And I think today's conversation has elevated the sophistication of the conversation up in a way you should take hold, which is that this idea of a sovereign wealth fund or the idea of an endowment, those notions of stabilizing the economy of Alaska because we've been highly dependent on one volatile commodity, I think is absolutely right. That's my own personal, the senator speaking's opinion. I've thought that for 16 years. And I mentioned in another hearing, I looked at trigger prices, the way Alberta does it, but some way of stabilizing. But the broader question that our neighbors will ask and we'll ask is, what about production? We just altered ACEs to incentivize that. Of course, the price of oil dropped. Which parts of that are affecting the industry or not? How would new oil wealth affect the sovereign wealth fund or an endowment? How can we protect against the upside? I think, Mr. Attorney General, your chart that showed the spending linked to the price of oil was pretty accurate and insightful for the public to see that it is in fact pretty true that the legislature will spend sort of what they have. And I don't think that bodes well for the future. So if we do have new revenues coming in from these developments and from the gas line, how do we protect on the upside? So I'd also encourage you to incorporate that. And then Senator Huggins' point about the gas line, that's the second thing on everyone's mind, is what are we going to do? This administration has made that sort of their major point in getting elected and in conversations. What's the plan? And we still don't know what that plan is. And it's important that we do because it's a trust factor. We have AGDC sitting over here. It's a model we created, actually. And some members of your administration, frankly, opposed publicly and are now embracing. And that's great because you see the value of it. You see the nimble nature of it. But what is it? What is your intent with that? And how much of the capital that we're talking about now will go into that? And what do we expect it to bring in the future? Because that's a hydrocarbon revenue that we don't have yet. But Alaskans expect it. They've been expecting commercialization of North Slope gas. That's a fair thing to look at in the future. So just as you start with your optimism that I like, that days aren't the same, they're different, I think they could be even better into the future if we get the Chukchi and the Beaufort developed. The Arctic itself and some of these new transportation modalities that come in, the gas line and the opportunity it presents to lower the cost of energy and attract manufacturing sectors. But we need to be talking about all of this.
Senator McGuire from the chair, we hear you loud and clear, and we have already been working on the exercise of what would more optimistic petroleum outcomes look like in terms of a royalty-based dividend, and what would they look like in terms of the governor's financial plan and in terms of long-term state fiscal health. So that's something we've been putting together the last couple of weeks, and we'll get to you as soon as we have the opportunity to present it.
Great.
Why don't we let you guys, oh, Senator Huggins, then we're going to let you guys to plow ahead. And we,
yeah, Mr. Chairman, thanks. Just, you know, across, because you had the long-term implications. You know, today we're sitting here and looking at a course of action of how to stabilize the economy based on protecting the permanent fund. You know, as Senator McGuire talked about, one of the things that Alaskans are paying attention to, probably second to a couple things, but certainly the pipeline, there's some hope. Some people are doom and gloom, but in any event. But, you know, the governor has proposed, I think he campaigned on 51% of it. Right now we're 25%. So I guess the first one, we're settled on 25%, is that right? Or is it 51%? Because it comes to play when we go down a bit further to my question.
Equity, you mean equity?
Yeah, equity. We're partnered, 25%. Is that the number?
That is through the chair, Senator Huggins, that is the number.
Senator Huggins, I mean, it's subject to the royalty in kind, royalty in value finding that DNR makes, but certainly all the expectations are that 25% is the number they're analyzing. But
I'm just going to interject, is that your final answer?
Yeah, no,
I'm serious.
I'm not asking a trick question, because the next step is, because we're talking about the gas pipeline, and we really want to talk about the revenues off the other end of it, given some assumptions of all the parameters that you derive revenue from. In net value, is we have to build that, right? And if we own 25% of it, we're equity, all right? Or we have 50%, that's a big number. And so the 25%, and so that's what we'll base. But, you know, it's easy to assume that Japan's going to pay for it if they're our anchor customer. Are they going to, you know, whatever, how we're going to work on our 25% factor. On the other hand, I don't think it's a secret. There has been conversations about the permanent fund playing part of that piece, and I think it's fair for Alaskans if that we not solve this chapter of what we're going to do the permanent fund, and then say, you know, and now we're going to fund, or it's a part of the mechanism for funding a gas pipeline. I think it's fair for us if that is one of the feasible courses of action, that Alaskans understand the implications of that feasible use of course of action. And I don't need your answer on that. I just think we as Alaskans need to make sure we understand the things in the near future that the gas, or correction, the permanent fund might be entertained as a solution. Doesn't mean you use it, but it will be asked that question.
We'll probe more on that. That's the question that's come up from some of my folks spontaneously, is how are you going to spend the permanent fund twice, once for the government and once for the debt? It's serious. I mean, that's been brought up. So you guys can delve into that later.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So moving on to the next section, where I'll really be addressing what we looked at in terms of the we're starting here with a quote from Governor Hayman when the fund was set up. His view was that, I wanted to transform oil wells pumping oil for a finite period of time into money wells pumping money for infinity. And if you share that view of what our permanent fund and our sovereign wealth assets ultimately will be, we want to figure out the way that we optimize the pumping of the money for infinity. So,
And beyond.
Thank you, Governor Hammond.
Thank you, indeed. The first start of the exercise is we had to decide, we knew that we wanted to spend the permanent fund earnings sustainably. And what that means is that we preserved an appropriate amount of wealth across generations going forward, and also that we sustained and use our financial assets to sustain a level of government that could also be maintained equitably across generations. So ultimately, in trying to figure out how to do that, I think it's important to develop a definition of sustainability and what it means. And in the way we approached this exercise, sustainable meant, one, that we protect the constitutionally protected corpus, two, that we have earnings reserve durability. That means since we're not going to plan on spending the corpus of the fund itself, we need to make sure the earnings reserve has a very high chance of having enough money in it to do whatever the plan is. So that's part of the test, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And the last part is the definition of sustainability that we adopted for our modeling included inflation. So that means that we not only are protecting the corpus of the fund in its absolute amount, but that we are growing the permanent fund by an amount every year that equals inflation. So that was another part of our definition. And ultimately,
on inflation proofing, Mr. Attorney General, is that through an appropriation mechanism as we're currently using, or managing the fund that provides for an inflationary proof guarantee? I've heard it carried. I just want to make sure the public understands this.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I flip to the next slide, which is the plumbing of the cash flows under the governor's plan. And to address your specific question, can I get to it in about a minute after I explain?
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. So the governor's plan is very similar to what we have in place now. It changes a few of the cash flows, but otherwise is very similar to the existing model. And under the existing model, the permanent fund corpus produces statutory net income to the earnings reserve. And out of the earnings reserve, inflation proofing goes back to the corpus, dividends come out, and that's pretty much the system. And over time, to the extent that dividend payouts and inflation proofing is less than the statutory net income, the earnings reserve grows. So that's our system. And roughly 30% of royalties are currently going into the permanent fund, into the corpus. The way our system changes that plumbing slightly is we put into the permanent fund all of the royalties, and we put into the permanent fund all production taxes. And then out of the corpus of the permanent fund comes the same statutory net income that goes to the earnings reserve. And then what comes out of the earnings reserve is the dividend payment, which in the governor's plan is 50% of last year's royalties, and a steady state $3.3 billion to the general fund. And other than one more cash flow, which addresses your question, Senator, that's it. That's the whole system. The oil revenues go into the permanent fund. The corpus produces income to the earnings reserve, and out of the earnings reserve comes the dividend and $3.3 billion to the general fund.
I'm looking at one arrow going into the corpus. Now, we currently have more arrows going in than one. So
exactly, Senator. So right now there's one arrow leaving the corpus and one arrow, two arrows going in. The first
getting rid of one tap and adding a drain?
we're not, because although we are changing the way inflation proofing works into the corpus, we are still allowing a mechanism for inflation proofing. And let me explain that piece. The way we've drafted the bill, and remember how I spoke about we need to have a durable earnings reserve? That means it has to be large enough that we have a high degree of confidence that a statutory net income to the earnings reserve is low for a few years because the market performs badly. We need to be confident that the earnings reserve has enough money that it can meet its cash calls, which includes the dividend payout and the $3.3 billion to the general fund. So what we do is we change inflation proofing as it exists now by eliminating that provision, but instead we have a provision that when the earnings reserve is greater than four times the $3.3 billion payout, that everything extra in the earnings reserve goes back into the corpus. So rather than an annual inflation proofing, we have a delayed inflation proofing mechanism that occurs over time as the earnings reserve reaches that four times target.
Senator Wilkowski.
I'm just trying to model the numbers based on the fall forecast. And can you just correct me if I'm wrong? So the mineral royalties, you've got 75%. So the royalties in 2016 were $650 million. So you put in 75% of that?
Yes.
Okay, so then, let's see. And then you put in the oil and gas production tax, which is $172 million. And then, so let's see, that's, $500 million plus $172 is $672 million. And then, roughly, I mean, it's just rough numbers. And then to calculate the dividend, you would divide that number by two?
Royalties by two.
The royalties. Okay, so the dividend is only calculated based on the royalties?
Correct. Yes.
So if the royalties that were put in were roughly $500 million, you're dividing that by two, that's roughly $250 million for royalties?
Yes, under that math.
Divided by 700,000 Alaskans is not a very big dividend. $300, $400 dividend?
through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. The 50% is 50% of total royalties, not just the 75% that's going in. So it's the number's a little higher than that. But, yes, if oil prices stay at $30 a barrel, the dividend will be low.
So under the 2016 forecast, it would have been $300, $400, $500 royalty or dividend? Is that about right?
I think that's accurate, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Please, did you have a question?
I was just going to bring up, that's what I meant yesterday by the last time we met, was shifting the risk to the permanent fund, stabilizing government, and we got to get some buy-off on that. I see a real problem there, so we're going to have to balance that probably.
I don't think these questions are confrontational. I think they're educational, and that's what the public's wanting to hear. This has been in a very vague concept. So, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and I agree with Senator Coghill, and I appreciate. I think this chart is very well done, and it is precisely the root of the conversation that we need to have with the public. I mean, there's certainly a way of creating a sovereign wealth fund or an endowment that allows for dividends to be just paid out of them strictly, and so that the risk is apportioned, if you will. But the thinking on this model and my model is that if you take the chance to connect royalties and their success or failure, and ultimately the success of Alaska's economy, to that check that people receive, that you create a new chapter in Alaska's history. That up to this point, there's been a very amorphous understanding of where this money comes from. I think it played out very poignantly in this last debate on Prop 1. Whatever side you were on, it was clear that many Alaskans didn't understand the percentage of oil revenue that actually made up the economy. I mean, I think people centered around 42%. And so the thinking is that if we're all in it together and we're all rooting for the success in both our actions and words of the economy, in our royalties, new revenue that comes from the gas line and other mineral proceeds, that's a healthier relationship. But it's certainly a conversation. On the other hand, if you decided to absorb that risk back in and say that the dividend would be one of your primary points, you have to recognize that the exchange is that you're going to lower the amount of government take to stabilize the economy. And that, in turn, brings you back to the point of bond ratings, what that does not just to us and our ability to borrow at higher rates potentially, but the signals that go out in a small state of 735,000 people where the relationship between the private and public sector is so intimate, that now you're looking at lending from the few banks we have, what those rates are, private companies and their capital budgets, you know, capital budget A or B, and then what that ultimately does to layoffs or future hirings and then housing rates. And so for me, I think you're exactly right on point, that this is the philosophical question about whether or not and you have Representative Hawker's version, which does not preserve a dividend at all. So you sort of have three different iterations: his, which preserves none; yours, which preserves a little less; mine preserves a little more; or a hypothetical fourth that would protect it almost entirely and share that risk with the government. But certainly the government would be less stable.
Senator McGuire, through the chair. Oh, that's fine. No, I think it was actually very on point. And the point I would make is whether you're talking about the governor's proposal or you're talking about Senator McGuire's proposal, both of these proposals, in terms of how the formulaic rules you use to spend your wealth, they can accommodate any number of ways to calculate the dividend. The method of paying out the dividend is flexible in all of these plans. It just has consequences in the relative amount of money that goes to the general fund versus goes out in dividends and the timings of those cash flows. So Mr. Hotback will talk about, you can frankly rationalize a number of ways to calculate dividends, and they can all be accommodated.
Senator Coghill.
Yeah, and the accommodation is going to be a rough discussion in so many ways, because the discussion on right-sizing government or what services do you really want is probably a brutal discussion in so many ways. And then the change of dynamic from using the sovereign wealth, instead of sharing it with generations, you're going to be consuming it more on your annual expenses, stabilizing them, granted, and teaching future generations. So school is a big deal. So those are the questions philosophically that we're going to get into. And then we have these structural issues, like we have set up in our Constitution a couple of different structures, including what the CBR is and the permanent fund structure itself. So it's a sea change in what our income is, and I think people will have to see, as we go through these very, very tough discussions, it's a sea change on how we manage it. So I'm not just saying all the risks should go to the government, but the expectation of participating in the wealth of the land, which is forbidden us to get to, is a big deal to us. And so I can't go drill a hole on my property and get anything out of it without... in fact, you can come to my property and drill beyond mine by leasing it out. And so that's a protection element that I think you need to keep in your focus all along the way, because we're asking people, first of all, they gave up the right to their subsurface, with the exception of some of the Native Corporation. And this was a way that many of us thought was equitably sharing in that. Anyway, I just wanted to put that in part of the equation as we talk about it, because that's why it gets exceeding difficult.
We got just a little bit more than 15 minutes left. I don't want to get to the constitutional issue today. I think they would be doing a disservice if we limited it to 15 minutes, so I would like it. At least the Attorney General back, and certainly you guys have all discussed it. But let's let you plow through the rest of your program, your rest of your agenda, and that will be one of the main items on the docket. I think there's been a lot of interest, but 15 minutes we'd do a real disservice if we tried to. That wouldn't even handle Senator Mulikowski's portion.
Thank you, Senator. So my next slide here goes to a core mechanic of a rule-based system, regardless of whether it's Senator McGuire's plan or whether it is the governor's plan. As Mr. Reitveld testified, the state of Alaska has historically had a fiscal rule for savings. We save 30% of royalties. That's a fine fiscal rule. It's worked well for us. What we have not had, by design and on purpose, is a fiscal rule for how we spend out of the permanent fund. And if you're going to spend out of the permanent fund and you want that spending to be sustainable, a core value is you have to define your fiscal rule for how you spend. And there's really two big ways we looked at, and by we I mean Economic Research Group and the Governor's Office and sort of analyzing it. You can do what is called a percentage of market value, and what a percentage of market value does is it says, you know, we assume we're going to earn something like 7%, inflation is going to be something like 2-2.5%. That means if we want to maintain the real value of the fund, we want to match inflation, we can pull out something between 4-5%, and it is sustainable and will protect the real value of the fund. That's a method of doing it, and it's a good method of doing it. Another method of doing it is what the Alaska Permanent Fund Protection Act does, and it basically treats your savings as an annuity, and it calculates just like your retirement guru might tell you, hey, you've got this amount in assets in retirement, and that means that you can have $25,000 a month out of your retirement assets and sustain the value to give your kids when you die. It's kind of the same concept. But there are trade-offs between these two methods. So I just wanted to briefly describe some of the trade-offs that we found. So by far the advantage of a percentage of market value is that it self-adjusts the amount that comes out of the fund. So if you have a situation where you have a number of bad years and the fund doesn't grow or maybe even shrinks a little bit, over time the percentage of market value, the payout will decrease because the value of the fund decreases. So there's sort of an adjusting mechanism for the payout. That is both a positive and a negative. It really comes down to where do you want the risk. If you want that market risk in your budget, then percentage payout makes sense. If you would rather maintain that risk in the permanent fund, then the fixed draw makes a little more sense. So the other advantage of, and both of those are rational, I think that the governor's plan ultimately decided, just like oil price volatility, we would rather manage the volatility of stock market returns and the permanent fund itself rather than the year-to-year budget. But certainly a percentage of market value is a reasonable and rational way to do a draw as well. So what that means is if you use a fixed system, because you are managing the volatility in the permanent fund and you're not managing it through changing the draw amount, is that you need some kind of system, just like an annuity calculation, just like we do with our retirement assets and those annuity calculations, where you periodically come in and say, okay, we're pulling $3.3 billion to government every year. Based upon what's happened in the stock market and what's happened in the oil markets, is that sustainable? So the governor's plan, because it went with the fixed draw, builds in that periodic review mechanism to essentially check to make sure the annuity calculation is still meeting your targets. So the next item here is that year-to-year budget volatility resides more in the budget. I'm sorry, year-to-year market volatility resides more in the budget under PMOV, and it relies less in the budget under a fixed draw. And then the final point is, if you believe in the concept that certainly the governor's plan does, and I've come very much to believe, that you should use your sovereign wealth assets to buffer volatility by putting petroleum revenues in them and drawing out something that is either a fixed or percent draw, it gets very complicated to do some of the math calculations with the percentage of market value. So if you're going to use a percentage of market value formula in combination with addressing volatility, you probably need a periodic review of the amount of the percentage of market value draw. And then one final super academic point, but one that I really don't want to get lost on the legislature, and I had opportunity to speak to Senator McGuire's staff about this. If you're going to do a percentage of market value, you need to make sure you do it on the value of the permanent fund assets less debt. You don't want to get in a situation right now, the permanent fund has about $7 billion in leverage, something like that. A lot of it's in the real estate portfolio, right? You know, they go out there, buy a shopping mall, and they finance it with whatever they finance it with, half debt, half equity. You don't want to borrow money and then turn around and pay out percentage of market value on the debt you borrowed. That's sort of the death cycle. So that's just a matter of getting the definitions right. Now, this is the other issue of why I think the governor's plan is a little bit better than percentage of market value. Percentage of market value gets you most of the way there in a rules-based framework. But what it doesn't get you is it doesn't exactly address the long-term problem of oil price volatility as it rolls through the economy and the state budget. This is a hypothetical exercise where ERG went back in time, and the blue bars are the annual petroleum revenues. The red bars are, if we had enacted percentage of market value in 2003, what would that have resulted in an extra skin of revenue on top of existing petroleum revenues? Well, it demonstrates that what a PMOV model without addressing volatility does is it just layers an extra skin of revenue onto your already volatile petroleum revenues. So in downtimes when oil prices are low, this is a good thing because it means that you're getting additional money into the system to help meet your budget shortfalls. But in high oil price times, it could actually be viewed as a bad thing if you don't otherwise address the volatility, because you're already experiencing pro-cyclical spending. You already have large capital budgets. You already are growing your operating budget. You're already, you know, under challenge to save enough in the high oil price environment times anyway. So layering on endowment funds in an already sort of superheated budget environment seems to me to be less than an optimal approach.
Why not put a revenue/spending limit mechanism in there, which is best enforced in the Constitution, but you have a statute. Amenable to that?
So, Senator Chairman, I'm certainly amenable to look at it. I mean, there's a number
of Alaskans are amenable to it.
There's a number of ways to skin the cat when you address all of these issues, and volatility is another one. You might be able to figure out how to do it through spending limits. You might be able to do it through endowment draw rules. The governor's approach does it through an annuity concept because we thought that was the cleanest.
And those from the Humane Society, that was the Attorney General's metaphor, not mine. Senator McGuire.
Well, just briefly, because we'll have a lot more hearings on this. I appreciate the latitude of the chair and of you gentlemen today, because I mean, I think this is what the public wants us to get into this discussion and finally here. I don't disagree at all. One, thank you, and we're looking at that fact in the office about the debt, and are going to reflect that. The second part is we played around in Senate Bill 114 with the idea of a range that would be actually subject to annual decision making by a specific group of individuals, likely the Permanent Fund Board, who are financial experts. So right now you see a placeholder of a percentage. Mike Hawker's percentage, I think, has been reduced to 4%. I don't disagree with you that that is one place where you could have more latitude and protection. And I also like what Senator Stoltz said, and I think the public's going to like it better if we can build in some of those other safety measures as well. So, but either one work. It's not a question. They both work. I think your annuity concept is fine, too. I get it.
Senator McGuire, through the chair. So finding a way to adjust the PMOV payment down and up to reflect what it needs to reflect without boring people with the math, I've been calling that the Gunner Knapp six-pack challenge.
Yes.
Because I offered him that challenge and to find a way to do it, and I'm sure it's out there, but we didn't find it.
Okay. Fair point.
And that's why I said in this slide, not being able to come up with a mathematical rules-based formula that worked well, I would suggest you do it through a periodic review unless you come up with that formula.
Okay.
So the governor's annuity model, and I, again, if I try not to get in the weeds here too much, it basically assumes that the starting value of the permanent fund is $55 billion, and that includes $2 billion in what as of the target date for starting the exercise, it was. It's now come down a couple billion dollars, $3 billion. But it also includes a $3 billion transfer from the CBR to the earnings reserve. And I'll talk a few slides later about the specific reason we're transferring $3 billion from the CBR to the earnings reserve. It is not to make the base level of assets larger so you can draw down a little more. It is instead to ensure that the earnings reserve is large enough that we have a high probability that we will ride out low probability bad start market events, even if they occur, to maintain a stable system. So the next major, and these are the major, what I'm doing here is I'm going through the major assumptions of the model just in two slides, because between your major assumptions, which is how much do you start with, what's your return rate, what's your inflation rate, how much are oil prices, this drives like all of the risk and all of, however you model it, these are the things that will influence how much you can take out of the system and where the risk is in doing so. So we assumed a 2.25% inflation rate. And then a little bit more controversial piece in the sense of probably the hardest one to develop internal alignment on is what do you use for a total return. When we first offered the bill in December, we had a two-step system to, and this is what return rate do we assume the permanent fund is going to earn in the future over 20 years? Because you have to, like, just like with retirement assets, you have to project earnings to be able to decide how much you can take today. And we assumed initially 6.4%, and that was sort of a compromise between different views of averaging the permanent fund's forecast with the 10-year historical return data. But when McKinsey came in and looked at it, they were strongly of the opinion that from, you know, a financial perspective, that using a historical average in your long-term forecast wasn't statistically supportable. So we changed it from 6.4 to 6.9, to reflect what is Callan's, the permanent fund's financial advisor's, their own forecast of what the permanent fund will return over the next 10 years. Now, if we had a 20-year forecast from Callan, I don't know that anybody does 20-year forecast, we could have used that as well, but the 10-year forecast was the best and most independent information that we had available. The best reflected the asset allocation of the permanent fund itself.
Thank you. Just on the numbers here, with the market decline, I don't know how current these numbers are. I just looked online and said that the total value of the permanent fund is $49 billion. I assume that includes the earnings reserve.
49.175 is
is that 55 number? Is the earnings reserve included on the permanent?
Yes.
Okay, so it's actually dropped $6 billion.
So no, because three of that is the three we're proposing transferring from the CBR.
Yeah.
It has dropped $3
billion. $3 billion.
And what we used for the basis of our financial modeling, because you have to pick a point in time, no matter what system you're using, we use what was the projected ending value as of the end of fiscal year 16. So that was $55 billion.
And it's sort of the dilemma, if you retire and the stock market crashes,
you're in a whole different situation. So it's dropped $3 billion since these numbers here. How does that look? People are predicting possible bear market for next year, 2 years. If this drops, if it's now $3 billion less, how does that impact your calculations? You have to pull another $3 billion from the CBR?
So, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair. So a couple different ways to think about it. One is the raw numbers. If you reduce the total value of the fund and the annuity calculations by $3 billion, that roughly reduces the amount you can sustainably draw by a little less than $100 million. That's one way to look at it.
So if I could, Mr. Chair. So instead of pulling 3.3, you now pull
3.2. Okay. Now, I'll stand by the fact that when you do these exercises, you should pick your target dates and rely, because you can't chase every day. You've got to pick a reasonable period of time in which to make your assumptions and do your projections that are robust and flexible. But, you can't chase in these assumptions every day's stock market performance. And I think when I at least think about the risk of having short-term poor performance in the stock market is impacting the model, I worry a lot less about how it impacts the sustainability of the 3.3 over time than I do about the durability of the earnings reserve. Because under the kind of analysis we've done where we're looking out 20-something years with $55 billion, I think it's fairly safe to say over a 20-year period that return over time will divert to some kind of mean around 6.9%. We might have some bad years, we might have some good years, but unless the future looks fundamentally different than the past, we can assume that global markets, as invested in by the permanent fund, will climb over time in a jerky way. So what I said is I don't worry too much about short-term drop-offs in terms of what's sustainable. I worry about it a lot more in terms of, is the earnings reserve big enough to sustain your PMOV model, if that's what you're using, or your fixed draw model. So that's why we added the $3 billion in there, to give us a little bit of cushioning in the earnings reserve that if we do get a couple of bad stock market years, that earnings reserve doesn't get run down.
I hope you have better luck getting a deposit from the CBR with the earnings. Better luck. And we were trying to put it in the corpus. Kind of hit a stone wall from both the governor and the Democrats.
Mr. Chairman, I hope we have better luck, too.
I don't know, hope you. I mean, I guess generic. Wish you well, sir.
So the next couple of major pieces to the model is we have to forecast oil prices, and we already spoke a little bit about this. Traditionally, in the revenue sources book, they use a mean price projection. They do sort of a survey of a bunch of people, and they find what the mean answer is. Actually, it's I think the median, not the mean. They don't average because they always have some outliers of guys who think oil is going to be $500. So they take the middle number, and that's what they project oil prices to be going forward. We used a much more sophisticated way, or not we, ERG used a much more sophisticated way to model it for this exercise.
ERG.
Economic Researchers Group. That's the group within the tax division that does a lot of the complex modeling for the Department of Revenue. They looked at oil prices probabilistically, which is rather than just picking a price and pushing it forward, or maybe changing it based upon another price in a certain amount of time, they instead look at what they think the range of oil prices is going to be and the probability of those ranges, and they run, I don't want to get too deep into this, they run the model, 1,000 or 2,000 times with sort of you roll the dice to determine what the oil price is under your assumption of all the volatility it could be and where it could be. And out of that, you get not just a point in price, you get a whole range of prices and how much money you would make across those whole ranges and what the probability of each of those different revenue outcomes are. So that's how we did oil price. But for our purposes, the key things are, and John Tohosky will talk about this later, the key thing I think for us is that the mean value, the average value, is about $56 a barrel.
We're right at 10:30. You guys mind us giving an extra 5 minutes, I want to give the Attorney General a chance to close strong here, and because we've diverted him a little bit. But if you have five more minutes, so you can kind of wrap up and give your best play on the table.
Chairman Stoltz, if we got the 5 minute limit, I would say if we could postpone the discussion on the dividend to the next meeting.
No, uninterrupted here. So okay. You got 5 minutes, and we won't
except for this.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a favor?
It's yes.
Just a consideration. I personally, I don't want to lose the detail of where we are, right. And my question would just be, could they close and come back?
Absolutely. But this is the first presentation. I'd like to give the sponsors the courtesy of making their best case. And
great.
So but that's we will follow that and appreciate that. Thank you.
So I'll pick up on this slide with the detail now.
These are for your sound bites.
My sound bites. So this is the best plan ever. So I think the sound bites, and I'll really go back to Commissioner Hoffback's presentation at the very beginning, where this is a simple rules-based formula. It really makes few changes from our status quo rules-based formula. You know, one of the things that the people that set up the permanent fund and the people that have been in the legislature, you really have to be complimented, because we have a rules-based framework that is constitutional in the form of its savings rule, 25% of royalties. But 35 years ago, the legislature overlaid on top of a constitutional system, a statutory system, subject to change by majority vote. And that statutory system did a couple of things. It inflation-proofed the fund, it provided for a dividend, and then a custom developed around a third thing, which is the legislature doesn't spend the earnings reserve except for inflation-proofing and dividends. So even though it only required a majority vote for the legislature not to follow the rules-based system, they did, through custom and expectation and just the way the body has operated. And this has been an amazing outcome for the state, because it's resulted in us having $49.175 billion in savings. So what we're doing today is we are slightly modifying those rules, or proposing to slightly modify those rules, and add in one more rule, two more rules. One is to increase from 30% royalties what goes into the fund to half of the royalties practically and all the production taxes. And the second thing is, for the first time, devise a spending rule. One that takes money out of the fund under a formulaic, calculable basis that is meant to be sustainable for general fund spending. So in that sense, I think that the governor's plan, like Senator McGuire's, frankly, is not complex, it's understandable, and it is really a variation of our existing plan with the one added spending rule.
Well, very good. Well, next we will start where we left off here. I'm going to have just one question to ask you. Is this to scale? I just want to make sure the little barrel for dividends. I just want to know. Give you a chance. I don't want you guys to get burnt by your own graphics. There's the dividends, and it looks like a little tiny barrel. And I don't want you guys to.
Unfortunately, it is to scale, Mr. Chairman.
And what I'd like to, as we discussed previously. We'll have a discussion of some of the legal issues. I would like the Attorney General, you have probably a succession of, I'm sure you guys have a pretty good filing system over there. There have been more than one opinions on disposition of the earnings reserve, constitutional budget reserve, in the vein of the legal opinions, which are, you probably have a pretty good grouping of those. Please make those available to the committee unless they're confidential. I assume they were not, because they were to pronounce the force of law by your predecessors.
So, Mr. Chairman, certainly, yes, all of the Attorney General opinions and all of the opinions we've written.
And there's probably a lot of them, maybe even if you gave a catalog index, I think they have a big pile. And I think we have some people that are very familiar with the law and other folks there. And just for our management of this issue, I think this committee is going to be granted a lot of latitude to spend time on this. The Finance Committee is really focused on the budget right now, and in fact, the next referral is the Finance Committee. We were going to take advantage of doing our due diligence here on behalf of the whole body and the people. That will include discussion of Senator McGuire's proposal and other thoughts and ideas, and so we're going to spend a couple weeks on this, and until I get the that big long hook from somebody else that we have to move on. And but I think the public expects us to duly deliberate, and by the time this goes through finance, and this a dozen members will have seen it in committee at minimum, and many others are watching it. So we're trying to have the schedule out later today.
we don't have a fully vetted plan, but I think I'd like to get a little flavor from the public, and if certainly the folks that are able to attend, we'd like to have some evening meetings and hear where the public's direction is, so we're going to try to have at least one evening meeting, and that so we'll plan for that. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thanks. Just 30 seconds. Number one, compliment the chair on both the spirit of what we're doing and the management of how we're doing that. But clearly, I think most Alaskans realize that this is a chance for education to learn, and appreciate both the people that testified today that wasn't impassioned, it was more fact-filled. And there were some questions to ask, and we need to fill those out. The other one, though, is I read where Clem Tillian is in the building, right? I don't know where Clem's position is on this, but I said he's down here advocating against it. Well, that may be okay. Most important for us, though, is that there are lots of people. I mean, Senator Wilkowski and I may not agree on issues, but we can talk about it. And it's the business of listening to what the other perspective is, and all of us in life. Never limit your discussions and your listening to those that you agree with. And there are symptoms of that happening on gas pipelines and things of that nature. Let's be open-minded. If the person is a good advocate, let's listen to that. They may have some good ideas. Mr. Chairman, once again, thank you for your management of this committee and members for being productive in education.
Sure. And former representative, and I guess Governor Hemmings used to call him Reptilian, and former Senator Tillian, very generous with his time. As shy and reticent as he is, you could probably coax an opinion out of him. I would encourage you to talk to one of the people that was an architect of the permanent fund. And certainly things have changed since, but I think he's got some pretty good Alaskan values. And at the very least, you're going to have a good conversation. Yeah. So looking forward to our continued deliberations. Thank you to all the members for your insightful questions, and we're looking to a lot more. With that, we'll stand in adjournment.